am Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading today from presidential historian Michael Betzlaus's Presidents of War and his essay on Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the run-up to World War II. We pick up the story in June 1941. In June, when Germany invaded the Soviet Union, President Roosevelt told reporters, "Of course, we are going to give all the aid that we possibly can to Russia." The following month, Roosevelt ordered 4,400 Marines to replace British soldiers in Iceland. The U.S. Navy's Admiral Stark considered this directive practically an act of war. In August 1941, Roosevelt met with Churchill aboard the HMS Prince of Wales and the USS Augusta off Newfoundland. The Prime Minister beseeched Roosevelt to ask Congress to enter the war against Germany. He would rather have this, with no supplies for 6 months for England, than double the supplies and no declaration of war. President Roosevelt declined, but he offered to provide British escorts with U.S. armed vessels as far east as Iceland. Roosevelt also joined Churchill to issue a public document on Anglo-American goals and principles, which was called the Atlantic Charter. The Prime Minister privately found it astonishing that the United States, still technically neutral in the war, would join with a belligerent power in making such a declaration. Returning to London, Winston Churchill informed his war cabinet that Roosevelt had confided to him that he would become more and more provocative, and if the Germans did not like it, they could attack the American forces. In September, near Iceland, a German sub fired torpedoes at the U.S. destroyer Greer. Even though they missed, Roosevelt announced that should there be another incident, American commanders would shoot on sight. At that moment, Roosevelt was considering whether to confer with the Japanese Prime Minister Prince Fuminero Kanoe in Alaska for an effort to make peace in the Pacific. While the President and the American people were primarily absorbed by the crisis in Europe, his nation had been edging toward confrontation with Japan. During his first term as president, Roosevelt had embraced the doctrine created by Henry Stimson, his Secretary of War, while Stimson was Hoover's Secretary of State, that the United States would oppose any change to the territory of China or Japan that came by force. Abiding by the nation's isolationist move, however, Roosevelt did little in 1937 when Japan attacked China. In July 1940, when the militant Tokyo regime threatened Dutch, French, and British colonial possessions in Southeast Asia, Roosevelt imposed an embargo against Japan, forbidding many exports of oil, gasoline, steel, and iron, a significant action since at the time Japan relied on the United States for 80% of its petroleum. That fall, Japan made an alliance with Hitler and Mussolini. In early 1941, worried about the burden of a potential two-front war, Roosevelt authorized Secretary of State Cordell Hull to explore a détente with the Japanese envoy in Washington, Admiral Kichibiro Nomura. Benefiting from information gained from deciphering Japan's diplomatic code, Roosevelt privately observed that inside the Tokyo government, the Japs were having a real drag-down and knockout fight, trying to decide which way to jump. Roosevelt added, "It is terribly important for the control of the Atlantic for us to keep peace in the Pacific. I simply have not got enough Navy to go around." Then the president presided over a tragicomedy of errors. In July, although opting against a full gasoline and oil embargo, he increased the pressure on Japan by freezing its financial holdings in the United States. This would require the Japanese government to appeal for a new export license, which Roosevelt privately said he was inclined to grant, each time it wanted resources from America. Such export licenses were officially responsibility of Assistant Secretary of State Dean Acheson, who was disgruntled that the president had not imposed a complete ban on oil exports to Japan. Acheson doubted that such a move would risk moving Tokyo toward war because any rational Japanese would know that an attack in the United States would bring disaster for his country. While Roosevelt was away seeing Churchill in Newfoundland, the insubordinate Acheson decided to impose his own self-authorized ban on Japanese export licenses, which amounted to an oil embargo against Tokyo. By the time Roosevelt discovered Acheson's caprice in September, he feared that publicly reversing it would allow critics to charge him with appeasing Japan. The result was precisely what the president had not wanted, and an effective halt to trade between Japan and America. Roosevelt's ambassador in Tokyo, Joseph Grew, who had been his Groton classmate, warned that the impending vicious circle of reprisals and counter-reprisals would bring eventual war with Japan and America. With Japan's oil supplies declining rapidly and its government wary of the American naval buildup in the Pacific, Prime Minister of Japan Kinoe pressed for a summit with Roosevelt, saying, "Time is of the essence." But Secretary of War Stimson and other hawks, who were concerned about the prospect of the president improvising in private, pressed him to refuse. That October, Prime Minister Kinoe of Japan was ousted in favor of the more militant Hideki Tojo. The following month, Roosevelt asked Secretary of State Cordell Hull to make sure that his Washington talks with Nomura did not deteriorate and precipitate a crisis. The Japanese, however, rejected American offers of a six-month standstill. During the final week of November, the disheartened President Roosevelt warned his military advisors and Secretary of State Hull that the United States was likely to be assaulted soon. As Simpson told his diary, Roosevelt noted that the Japanese are notorious for attacking without warning, and the question was how to maneuver them into firing the first shot without too much danger to ourselves. On Thursday, November 27, 1941, General George Marshall wired Walter Short in Honolulu that negotiations with Japanese appear to be terminated and hostile action possible at any moment. If hostilities were unavoidable, the United States desires that Japan commit the first overt act, said Marshall. In the meantime, Marshall told General Short that he should undertake such reconnaissance and other measures as he deems necessary, but not alarm the civilian population. Admiral Stark's message to both Short and Admiral Kimmel was more blunt. This dispatch is to be considered a war warning. An aggressive move by Japan is expected in the next few days. Admiral Stark speculated that Japan might wage an amphibious expedition against either the Philippines, Thai or Krai Peninsula, or possibly towards Borneo. Stark ordered General Kimmel to execute an appropriate defensive deployment and appropriate measures against sabotage. General Short was not alarmed by the words war warning. To him, they suggested only that Japan was going to attack someplace. His Milky Toast reply to General Marshall should have alerted Marshall that Short did not comprehend that Pearl Harbor was now in danger of a serious attack, but General Marshall made no effort to set him straight in Honolulu. The uptight Marshall, willing to take blame where he deserved it, later acknowledged, "That was my opportunity to intervene, and I did not do it." Thus, General Short merely moved the forces in Hawaii from their existing number 2 alert against an attack from the skies to a number 1 alert, defense against local sabotage, in Honolulu. The general was not privy to the valuable intelligence that flowed from U.S. intercepts through the highly secret operation called MAGIC of coded Japanese cable traffic called PURPLE, which included messages between the foreign ministry in Tokyo and the consulate in Honolulu. This source offered clues that the Japanese were planning a spectacular surprise attack against U.S. forces in Hawaii. The highest officials in Washington feared that sharing this intelligence about Japan with local commanders might jeopardize MAGIC by tipping off Tokyo that the United States had broken its code, after which it would be changed. Kimmel and Short in Honolulu saw the rumors in the Honolulu papers. On November 30th, the Honolulu Advertiser newspaper warned, "Japanese may strike over weekend." But the two commanders there kept presuming that whatever Tokyo tried would be relatively modest. When someone proposed sending army planes to strengthen the defense of Wake and Midway Islands. Short's Air Chief, Colonel James Mollison, said, "Our mission is to protect Oahu, and shipping out these Army planes will lessen our capability to do so." Kimmel asked, "Why are you so worried about this? Do you think we are in danger of attack?" Colonel Mollison replied, "The Japanese have such a capability." But Kimmel scoffed, "Capability, yes, but possibility?" He asked his war plans aide, Captain Charles McMorris, "What do you think about the prospects of a Japanese air attack?" Captain McMorris assured him, "None, absolutely none." Convinced that the greatest possible danger to Pearl Harbor was probably a surprise attack by Japanese subs against his ships, Kimmel did not send Navy planes off on long-range missions to watch the skies for Japanese bombers. Instead, Kimmel stepped up efforts to make sure that in case the Japanese landed a major blow in the Philippines or someplace else, the U.S. sailors and ships of Pearl Harbor would be well poised to retaliate. General Short's response was, in retrospect, even worse. He ordered the Army planes at Pearl Harbor to be massed together. This might have made them easier to protect from lurking local saboteurs, but if there should be an aerial attack, the force would be easily and quickly destroyed. On Wednesday, December 3, 1941, Admiral Stark wired Kimmel from Washington that Tokyo's foreign ministry had sent urgent instructions to key diplomatic posts to destroy most of their codes and ciphers at once and to burn all other important and secret documents. This was a clear signal that the Japanese were on the verge of war. But Kimmel did not bother to share Stark's warning with his Army counterpart, and Pearl Harbor was left grievously unprepared. On the dismal night of Sunday, December 7th, after hearing the Pearl Harbor news, Americans stood vigil in front of the White House. The American death toll would be 2,403, with about half that many wounded. Many Americans would die at the hands of the Japanese attack than had perished in the entire War of 1812 against Britain. After receiving the first report from Hawaii, the president had worked upstairs on his stamp collection, grimly telling his oldest son, James, "I'm trying to keep everything calm and quiet as I can." That evening, in a radio speech already scheduled, his wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, confessed, "You cannot escape a clutch of fear at your heart." Roosevelt's Secret Service agent Mike Riley noted that evening that the president's chin stuck out about 2 feet in front of his knees, and he was the maddest Dutchman I or anybody ever saw. In his upstairs Oval study at 8:30 that night, the president told his department secretaries that this was the most serious cabinet meeting since the spring of 1861, when Abraham Lincoln had discussed his response to the Confederate attack on Fort Sumter. With horror, Secretary of War Henry Stimson noted that all the planes were in one place at Pearl Harbor. Attorney General Francis Biddle thought Roosevelt looked deeply shaken, graver than I had ever seen him. Secretary of Labor Francis Perkins felt that a great change had come over the commander-in-chief. Before Pearl Harbor, she said, he had been tense, worried, and carrying an awful burden of decision. But now his terrible moral problem had been resolved. Roosevelt's closest friend in the cabinet was his Hudson Valley neighbor, Henry Morgenthau, Jr., Secretary of the Treasury. When Morgenthau went home, he told his wife, Eleanor, that when Americans acquired full knowledge of what had occurred at Pearl Harbor, it is going to be the most terrific shock this country has ever had. Morgenthau was outraged, stating, "We have always been led to believe that the Navy was our first line of defense and Hawaii was impregnable. The whole fleet was in this little Pearl Harbor base. The whole fleet was there. They will never be able to explain it." After his cabinet departed, Roosevelt welcomed leaders of the House and Senate to the same room. Amid Roosevelt's beloved naval prints and artifacts of earlier American wars, Roosevelt told his guests, "A great fleet of Japanese bombers bombed our ships in Pearl Harbor and bombed all of our airfields. This afternoon, Guam was being bombed by 2 squadrons of Japanese planes. Wake Island was also attacked. We believe that Manila was attacked. I do not know what is happening at the present time, whether a night attack is on or not. It isn't quite dark yet in Hawaii. Of course, it is a terrible disappointment to be president in time of war. We have reason to believe that the Germans have told the Japanese that if Japan declares war, they will too. Despite this awful moment of national emergency, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Tom Connally, frankly told Roosevelt that he could not understand why we were taken off our guard at Pearl Harbor. Senator Connally kept asking, "Mr. President, how could this thing happen?" President Roosevelt knew that his war leadership would be damaged from the start if Americans condemned him for the Pearl Harbor disaster, for letting so many ships be lined up like sitting ducks, or, far worse, for having deliberately encouraged an assault that would move heretofore reluctant Americans to demand involvement in the war. Thus, Roosevelt quickly acted to make sure that serious blame was placed not on himself, Secretary Stimson, General Marshall, or Secretary Knox, who would now have to lead the American fight, but on the commanders in Honolulu. 10 days after the attack, General Kimmel and Admiral Short were abruptly stripped of their posts. From Missouri, an ex-judge wrote Kimmel, "You would do America a favor if you would shoot yourself." Both officers received death threats. To establish who in the American government should be censured for Pearl Harbor, the president appointed a commission. He hoped that this would ward off calls from Republicans for a freewheeling congressional investigation. Supposedly, Roosevelt's panel was independent, but in fact, there was no possibility that he would grant it much leeway to implicate him in the Pearl Harbor disaster. If its report should indict him for mistakes or machinations that had thrust the United States into the war, Roosevelt and his entourage would be the target of vast public fury. Thus, it was in Roosevelt's interest to make sure that the focus was on Short and Kimmel. To chair the commission, Roosevelt selected the Supreme Court Justice Owen Roberts, an excellent choice for a president who wished to make sure it did not get out of control. Justice Roberts' exalted position would bring prestige to its verdict, and as a President Herbert Hoover appointee to the court, he could not be impugned as a partisan trying to give Roosevelt a Democrat political cover. Justice Roberts was known to be unassertive, which made him subject to the president's importuning, especially at the start of a war that at this moment the United States was losing. The justice was also discreet, as was later demonstrated when, after leaving the court in 1945, he destroyed his official papers. Roberts did not insist that Roosevelt, as a potential key figure in this inquiry, be kept at arm's length. He met privately with the president at the White House on December 16, 1941, the day the commission was announced, and at least twice more during its 7 weeks of deliberation, when they could not have avoided discussing what Roberts' report would say. In mid-January 1942, Roosevelt's long-term friend, Justice Felix Frankfurter, who had been a fount of confidential, shrewd advice on politics and personnel throughout the New Deal, suggested in a letter, beginning, "Dear Frank," about his colleague Roberts, stating that, "You get him alone, and not with other members of the board, to tell you of things that have no proper place in their report." Frankfurter assured him that Justice Roberts is not only, thank God, very modest, he is also truly shy. In late January, the Roberts Commission issued its report, which spared Roosevelt and assigned primary blame for the Hawaii catastrophe to dereliction of duty by Kimmel and Short in Honolulu, who had refused to confer and cooperate, and whose errors of judgment were the effective causes of the attack, while conceding that the two officers had not been adequately informed by Washington of the imminence of war. Secretary of War Stimson told his diary that if Short and Kimmel were allowed simply to retire, it might give the impression that we were trying to let off these people without punishment because we felt guilty ourselves. He noted Roosevelt's desire to wait about a week and then accept the two men's retirement with a pointed warning that they might yet be court-martialed, which could not be done now without the disclosure of military secrets. Demoted to Major General, Short resigned from the Army and took a minor role as traffic chief at a Ford Motor War plant in Dallas. He died of heart disease in 1949. Reduced to 2 stars, Admiral Kimmel quit the Navy to work for a marine engineering firm in New York, living, it was said, in suspended disgrace. After the Justice Roberts Commission verdict was issued, Admiral Kimmel wrote Admiral Stark, who was once his close friend, that he wished he had been smarter than I was about what might happen at Pearl Harbor. He did not wish to embarrass the government, but he warned that my crucifixion before the public has about reached the limit. Noting that irresponsible people all over the country were threatening to kill me, Admiral Kimmel asked Admiral Stark to have the War Department do nothing further to inflame the public against me. You must appreciate that the beating I have taken leaves very little that can be added to my burden. In his letter, Kimmel also made a veiled threat that if pushed too far, he might one day implicate his superiors in the Pearl Harbor imbroglio. I have kept my mouth shut and propose to do so as long as is humanly possible. In 1944, Kimmel's 31-year-old son Manning, a Navy submarine officer in the Pacific, died in action. Furious at Roosevelt, the ex-admiral cried, "That son of a bitch killed my son." That same year, the grieving father learned new facts about how the president's high command had broken the Japanese code to obtain tantalizing clues that the Japanese might attack Pearl Harbor. Kimmel complained that they never sent me a damn thing that told me the true story. His son, Edward, later recalled that his father now changed from a very dejected, downtrodden man into a fighting tiger. At the end of 1944, Stark wrote Admiral Kimmel of his satisfaction that the ex-admiral would not be court-martialed. In draft replies, which he did not send, Kimmel roared back, stating, "You betrayed the officers and the men of the fleet by not giving them a fighting chance for their lives, and you betrayed me by not giving me information you knew I was entitled to." Kimmel wrote that Admiral Stark should never communicate with me again, so that my memory may not be refreshed of one so despicable as you. He added, "May God forgive you for what you have done to me, for I never will." Kimmel fought in vain to regain his old military rank and for exoneration. His son Thomas observed, "You couldn't talk to him for 15 minutes without getting back to Pearl Harbor." In 1949, the ex-admiral started to write a Pearl Harbor memoir, but he wrote a friend, "The process made him so emotionally upset, he had to stop." The next year, he suffered a massive heart attack. In the book, Admiral Kimmel's Story, finally published in 1955, the author wrote, "I cannot excuse those in authority in Washington for what they did. They must answer on the day of judgment like any other criminal." In 1966, Kimmel told a reporter, "My principal occupation, what's kept me alive, is to expose the entire Pearl Harbor affair." Hard of hearing, he went on to loudly claim that Roosevelt, Marshall, and their circle had deliberately betrayed the men in Hawaii and made me the scapegoat. They wanted to get the United States into the war. FDR was the architect of the whole business, Kimmel said, stating it's obvious he wanted the Japanese to attack. In defiance of fact, he contended that all incriminating documents had been destroyed, adding that he didn't know whether the whole story will ever get out. After Admiral Kimmel died in 1968, he was interred at the Naval Academy in Annapolis under a gravestone defiantly emblazoned with 4 stars. Knowing that Marshall had been buried in Arlington National Cemetery and that Admiral Stark, who died in 1972, would be as well, the bitter old man had written his son Thomas, "I don't care where I'm buried, so long as it's not in Arlington." On Monday morning, December 8, 1941, Roosevelt awoke at 7:30. Secretary of Treasury Henry Morgenthau had ordered the Secret Service to double its guard around the president. He warned that somebody could put 20 men in a 5-ton truck, crash in there, and take over the White House. But when he asked for permission to surround the executive mansion with tanks, Roosevelt would accept only Army machine gunners. At midday, the president was driven to Capitol Hill. When Roosevelt had first dictated his address asking Congress for a war declaration against Japan, he had called December 7th, a date which will live in world history. Then shrewdly, he had deleted the final 2 words of this phrase in favor of the more pungent and memorable infamy. a noun that Theodore Roosevelt had employed in no less than five of his messages to Congress when president. Now in the same House chamber where he and Eleanor had watched Woodrow Wilson deliver his war address in 1917, Roosevelt asked the joint session to declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire. In his second-to-last sentence in his address, suggested by his aide, Harry Hopkins, Roosevelt vowed, "We will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God." The First Lady had thoughtfully invited Edith Wilson, Woodrow Wilson's wife, to sit next to her in the President's box. The scene filled Eleanor with a curious sense of repetition. Woodrow Wilson's war appeal had provoked 4 days of congressional debate. This time, there was almost none. The Japanese bombers at Pearl Harbor had united most of the country. On the Senate floor, Arthur Vandenberg said, "To the enemy we answer, you have unsheathed the sword, and by it you shall die." Acting within 33 minutes, the Senate approved Roosevelt's request by a vote of 82-0. The House of Representatives endorsed a war declaration by a vote of 388-1. Returning to the Oval Office, with Senate and House leaders standing above his shoulders, Roosevelt signed the document of war at 4:10 in the afternoon. With a minor exception the following year, Pearl Harbor would prove to be the last time in American history that a president ever asked Congress for a declaration of war. This ends Michael Betschloss's essay on Franklin Roosevelt and the run-up to World War II. It will be continued with Franklin Roosevelt during the war. This is Wallace Klinkhamst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.